Thank you for listening to the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. If you'd like to join our writing community on Discord and get access to fantasy writing classes and books on Patreon, check the links in the description. And if you don't want to miss any future episodes, be sure to follow or subscribe. And to support the show, leave a quick rating on Spotify or iTunes and share this episode on social media or with anyone who you think may be interested. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the show. Thank you for listening to the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and I'm delighted to be joined by author Kate J. Armstrong. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. If you're a little bit unfamiliar with Kate, her debut novel, Night Birds, was published by Penguin in 2023 to great acclaim. And the second book in the series, Firebirds, comes out in August of this year. Very exciting as well. Yeah. Yes. So we're going to talk all about both books today. And while we do so, we'll zoom in on the crafty things we love so much, like creating characters and plots and world building. And the magic system is very interesting in these stories as well. So definitely want to pick your brains about that. But I always like to start from the beginning when we speak with authors on the show. So tell us about you, Kate. How did you get into writing?
Well, I've always, I imagine everyone says this, but you know, I feel like I've always been a writer. I've always been scribbling since, for as long as I can remember. I think when I was younger, I wrote short stories, mostly about dragons and epic poetry. And I got to high school and was mostly writing poetry. And then I went to college and I was getting an English degree in literature. And the problem with getting a degree in literature, I found, is that the more you read the great books and, you know, the great writers, the more you start to get a complex about how nothing I write could possibly be this good.
Yeah.
And so I think I kind of psyched myself out in the years when I was in college. I was still writing, but I had never written anything longer than a short story. I think when I was maybe 14, I had written like four chapters, the beginning of a novel. And I still, to this day, really love writing beginnings, and everything after that is hard. But yeah, I think then I graduated from college and I didn't want to start working right away. I was like, what else can I do? So I saved up a bunch of money and I went backpacking, which, you know, I live in Australia now, and every Australian I talk to is like, yes, you went traveling after college, right? That's what we all do. And that wasn't the case for Americans. All my friends were like, you're doing what?
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to just get out and travel and see some of the world. And that's what I did. And meeting people in different cultures and just experiencing different ways of being really opened my eyes. And it invigorated me again and made me want to write. So yeah. I was thinking I would become a journalist, which is not exactly what happened, but I ended up finding my way to Australia, and I did get my master's degree there in journalism. But while I was getting that degree, I basically just fell back in love with writing stories and decided it was time for me to try to write a novel. I think I was 25 and I thought, okay, now is the time. Let's see if I can do it. And I think part of what took me so long is that I had it in mind that I needed to write these literary, large literary tomes of the kinds that I was enjoying in college. And yeah, it was finding my way back to genre, really, finding my way back to magic and back to fantasy that really helped me to find my voice in writing. So yeah, I wrote for about, oh gosh, a decade, I think. I wrote four or five manuscripts. They were all set in our world with a bit of a magical twist, so lots of speculative fiction. And Nightbirds was actually my first straight fantasy novel. And when I started writing that book, something really just clicked into place for me. And I found my home in fantasy. It was wonderful to get to make up my own rules, my own world. And yeah, there was just something about it that felt right. So yeah, and here I am.
That's a great story. It's interesting, like we always say about like travel broadens the mind, but it literally does, doesn't it? Like when you get out there and you see all these different ways of living your life, it does fill you with inspiration. I mean, have you got any favorite places that you've traveled to?
Oh, so many. I mean, my travels were definitely part of the inspiration for Nightbirds. The setting of the city of Cimta was very inspired by Venice. I've been to Venice a couple of times, and I
Nice.
think you can definitely see Venice in that setting. Also, New Orleans, which is a city I've always loved. I just love the feeling and the culture there. And a little bit of my now hometown of Melbourne, Australia. They have my city has a lot of winding secret laneways and teeny little bars tucked between, trash cans. And it's just a great city for discovering secret treasures. So yeah, it's hard to say favorite places, but I mean, I did end up moving to Australia, so I have to say that that is one of my
Yeah,
favorite places I've ever traveled.
well, there you go then. It's like I say, it just reinvigorates you with that inspiration, and that's so great that you found it. And journalism is a good one, isn't it? Because you are dealing with human stories day in, day out. So did you work as a journalist for a while?
I never did work as a journalist, but I did do. During the course of my career, a lot of reading, a lot of talking to people in the course of doing assignments and projects. And I
Yeah.
do love talking to people. And I ended up being a teacher, a high school teacher for several years, which is
Nice.
certainly not journalism, but I feel like my degree in journalism kind of led me there because I love interviewing people. I love talking to people. And just hearing their stories, it always invigorates my own and
Yeah.
has me thinking, has me thinking in ways that I wasn't thinking before. So I think reading a lot of good journalism was very inspirational for me. But when push came to shove, I realized that the pace of the world of journalism was too intense for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this is going to stress me out being a journalist. I'm not sure it's for me. And I had actually taken a bunch of classes in the course of my career in publishing as well, because I'd always been interested in the publishing world and working on the other side of the desk. And I ended up being an editor, a nonfiction editor, for quite a long time. I did some work for National Geographic. I've worked in-house for a couple of Australian publishers. So by the time I came around to getting published myself, I had been on the other side of the
Yeah.
desk, and I knew a lot of what went on in house, which was really helpful for me in making the whole process of publishing a little bit less confusing and terrifying, I have to say.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a good leg up there. So, tell us about Nightbirds then. This is the first book in the series. Firebirds has come out in at the end of August. So tell us a bit about that.
So, Nightbirds is set in a world where magic is illegal. So, imagine a 1920s style prohibition, except instead of on booze, it's on magic. And within this world, there's a group of girls called the Nightbirds, and they will give you a special and rare form of magic with just a kiss for a price. But first, you have to find them. They're a very exclusive club, and you need to know which ears to whisper in and which doors to knock on to find them. Their identities are the city's best kept secret. No one knows who they truly are. And these girls are relatively settled and happy in these privileged roles. They're treasured by the great houses, who are the sort of upper echelons of society who watch out for them and take care of them. But then the system starts to unravel and their identities start to be revealed. And they learn that perhaps this gilded world that they've been living in was actually a gilded cage all along, and they have to figure out what to do about it.
Nice.
And I actually have a podcast of my own with my friend and fellow author, Amy Kaufman. It's called Pub Dates. And this month we're doing a series of read-along episodes. So we're doing four different episodes where we basically recap everything that happened in Nightbirds. So if you were picking it up for the first time or you just want a refresher, you can always hop over there and have a listen.
There you go. So the
Great.
magic system sounds really interesting. The Nightbirds can pass on temporary powers, is that right?
Yes. So they can kiss someone and give them their magic, but it's only for a short time, maybe a couple of days, and then it'll wear off.
What kinds of abilities do they offer?
So they're all, I would call them kind of a glamour or illusion abilities for the most part. So Mathilde, one of our characters, can give you the ability to look like someone else completely. You sound like them, you look like them. So you can essentially take on their identity for a short time, which, can have all sorts of uses, both nefarious and not. Sayre, one of our other Nightbirds, can give you the gift of camouflage, so essentially make you invisible. And Asa, our third Nightbird, has perhaps the most potent power out of all of them. She gives you the ability to manipulate and change someone else's emotions. And you can argue that if you can manipulate someone's emotions, you can change the way they think and the way they act. So, and they all have different relationships with being a Nightbird, what that means, how comfortable they are with this system. I mean, really, this is a story about magical courtesans. That's what I was thinking as I was writing it. They're giving away something quite precious, something quite coveted, and they all have different feelings about what that means.
That's really interesting, and it's so unique. I've never come across anything like it, and it's such a clever way of using magic, because I always like magic when it's limited, and this is a really good way of doing it. But also, it's, I imagine, like, you had a lot of fun using that kind of system in the story as a means of, like, critiquing the sort of idiosyncrasies of our society.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was that one of the sort of driving forces behind the idea?
So I actually have yet another podcast. I've been running it for about 5 years. It's a history podcast called The Exploress, and it's essentially about women in history. So it's about time traveling back and finding out what life was like for women of the past. And I was deep into the first season of that show when I started writing Nightbirds. And it was really formative in what Nightbirds became, I think, because I was reading a lot, especially about the 19th century and what life was like for women in America and in the Western world. I was reading about prostitution and sex workers during the Civil War. And I just have always been fascinated by the fact that courtesans throughout history could be some of the most powerful women in their society. They were in a league of their own. They had access to political figures. They had a voice in a way that very few women around them did, but they could also find themselves in really precarious situations. They were always kind of doing this high wire act where if they were dealing with really exclusive and rich clients who could protect them, they could actually end up in a really powerful position, but they could also end up in very vulnerable positions. You know, it's being a courtesan, that is a role in which you can very easily be exploited. And so I had that rattling around in my head, and I had been thinking about this world where magic was illegal, and what would it mean if there was a prohibition on magic, and within this world, the most potent and powerful magic was only wielded by women. What would that look like? And so I took a lot of inspiration from history, the 1920s, obviously. I call it a 1920s tinted fantasy because it definitely has 1920s vibes culturally. But then we've got the Renaissance. We've got kind of the Victorian era in terms of this very patriarchal structure of the society. And these girls are essentially operating in a system where they are protected, their identities are protected. The whole idea behind the Nightbirds is these girls, so magic mostly runs through these great house bloodlines. And when a girl manifests her magic, she becomes a Nightbird for several years. And at the end of her service, she will marry someone rich and influential and sort of her choosing, although is he?
Yeah.
Unclear. A little bit murky. And, you know, she's going to have a rich and gilded life and pass her magic on to the next generation of women. And Mathilde, one of our main characters, is very indoctrinated in the system. Her grandmother was a Nightbird. She comes from a long line of them, and she thinks this is fine. There's no problem with the system. But the other two girls, Sayer and Asa, have come from outside the great houses. One's come from a far-flung island. The other has come from essentially like the other side of the tracks. Her mother was a Nightbird who fell from grace. And she's experienced life outside the protective glow of the great houses. So she is very jaded and brings a very different perspective and really makes Mathilde question. The whole book is questioning these structures of power, especially structures of power controlled by men. Who are they really meant to protect and to preserve? And these girls basically keep running up against that over and over and over. So yeah, I would say just loving history and reading about history and women in history was one of my biggest inspirations.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And the way you explore it as well and like challenge it within your story. I think I was interviewing a writer called Manda Scott And she's just written a similar kind of story that's sort of challenging these things. And I feel like it's becoming more important than ever now. I know we've made progress, but I don't think we've done enough. And I think writers should definitely start tackling it more in the stories, even if it's on like a not as focal a point. And what do you think? Do you think there's more of a need to do this kind of thing, or does it just depend on the story that you're trying to tell?
I absolutely think there's a need. I want people to read my story and be entertained, but I also want them to read Nightbirds and see a reflection of our world, the injustices in our world. I mean, most of the things that the girls experience, the small injustices, are things that I experienced or one of my friends experienced growing up. The way, the double standards, the just the things that women experience in the world, the many frustrations and limitations that they still experience. I think it's easy to say we've come a long way from where we once were, and it's true we have, but I think there's still a lot to say about the way we've built our society and who it benefits and who it doesn't. I mean, you know, the prohibition in my book is based very much on the 1920s. That was only about 100 years ago.
It's
And
mad.
while and if you look at that history, you can see that prohibition didn't really hurt the wealthy because they could afford to pay bribes and get around it. It created this really seedy underworld, criminal underworld, that you could argue was not good for America's, especially their major cities. And the people who really suffered under prohibition were often the poor and the marginalized. And isn't that so often true? It's still true of many of the laws and rules that we create today. So yeah, I absolutely think that every book is a reflection of the world we're living in some way. And I think we all need to be grappling with what our world looks like and what should we change. And I think that's what's wonderful about fantasy, especially young adult fantasy, is it creates this almost safe space to talk about really serious issues. I mean, when I was writing Firebirds, the sequel, Roe versus Wade had just been overturned in the States. I was thinking a lot about that and women's bodily autonomy and rights. And that absolutely, you know, if you read the book, you'll see that has worked its way right into Firebirds. Lots of questions about agency and about a woman's power over her own body and her own choices. I think we should be grappling with this stuff. And when you do it in fantasy, it creates this safe place to play with it. It doesn't feel as pointed. And so you can ask big questions that I think can be tougher to ask in a contemporary piece.
And sometimes just framing it in a different way and or telling it in a story form, it can connect with people on in different ways, and people absorb things and information in different ways too, don't they? So
Yeah, that's right.
so tell us about Firebirds.
Firebirds. Well, I got accused by many readers with Nightbirds of writing a cliffhanger. I didn't think it was a cliffhanger. I thought it was a gentle but steep slope down to the sea. So there were a lot of threads certainly left dangling at the end of Nightbirds, lots still to explore. And I was just so excited. I'd never written a sequel before. Never written more than you know, a standalone. And so it was a big challenge, but a really exciting challenge to get to continue to play around in this world and to see what else my characters were going to do. So in the Firebirds, you see that essentially the Nightbird system has been revealed. These girls cannot return to the life that they were living before, and the stakes have been raised because now in Nightbirds, most of society didn't know that girls with magic existed, were a thing. Now everybody knows. And so what does that, you know, what does that mean? What does that look like? How do people react? So you have the powers that be trying to control them, trying to create registries and getting girls to sign up for them. You have the church. The church is violently anti-magic and thinks that any girls with magic should be at best brought in for questioning, at worst killed. Historically, that's what they did with witches. And then you have the people who are really divided on what to do with girls with magic. And so the Nightbirds now feel a responsibility to, they're all, well, not all of them, but some of them are in a form of hiding. And they're all trying to figure out basically what is their role in what happens next. You know, is it Should they stand up for all girls with magic and try to create a safer world for them? Or do they just try to take care of themselves? They have a lot of problems that they need to tackle. And at the end of Nightbirds, all of the girls are separated, essentially, kind of physically and emotionally, and they have to work their way back to each other. So, yeah, we've got some, a lot of, I like to call them my bad daddies. We have a lot of bad man villains in book two that we need deal with. We have a foreign king who, that was one of my first ideas I had about the sequel, is I knew I wanted some foreign king who was lusting after magic. He doesn't have it where he lives. It only is in the Udean Republic where the story is set, and he wants it. And so we're going to have him trying to invade. So we're going to have to deal with a foreign threat. But you also have lots of internal threats. There is a, as I was talking about before, I was very inspired by real life with this. There is a new drug circulating the city that perhaps has the power to essentially take away a girl's agency and to force her to wield her magic, however the person who drugs her wills. So it's kind of like a magical date rape drug, a little bit. So very nefarious. It's darker than the first book, I think. It's darker, it's a little grittier, but we also get to see the girls do really big magic. We get to kind of see them finally become, you know, these magical entities, like own their power and really come into that power.
That's very cool. So when you were writing, well, you've probably gone back to Nightbirds for this question, but characters, the three Nightbirds play a huge role in this. So, can you tell us a bit about your character creation process?
When the idea first came to me, there was a short time when I thought the story was going to be single point of view. Mathilde was the first character to come to me, and I think in many ways she's the main character. She is the institutionalized Nightbird who comes from a long line of them, and I think she has in some ways the most to learn out of all the girls. She has to really, she's sheltered, she's kind of a sheltered rich girl who doesn't really know how the other half lives, and she learns eventually. But her voice was really strong to me, and so I thought, okay, well, I can see her, and I think that she'll make a great point of view character. But I very quickly realized I wanted to tell a story about how you can see a system like the Nightbird system from different angles and in different ways. And so I knew, okay, and it's also a story about sisterhood. It's a story about the bonds that these girls form and the power that can be found in female friendship, especially. And so I knew that the other Nightbirds needed to have their own voices and their own opinions. And so from there, I thought, well, who would make a good foil for Sayer? Pardon me, who would make a good foil for Mathilde? And the first one to come to me was Sayer, because she is very much like Mathilde. She comes from a great house family. They really could have lived very similar lives, but Sayers took a left turn because her mother was essentially kicked out of the system. She was almost exiled. And so Sayer has grown up in a really gritty part of the city, and she has just lived a very different life from Mathilde, and she's very resentful of the Nightbird system. And she forces Mathilde to confront that perhaps it doesn't protect its girls as well as it pretends to, and that it's more exploitative than Mathilde wants to admit. And then we have Asa. So Asa is the, she's the out, really the outsider. She's the fish out of water. She comes from a small country town. She's very nervous about magic. And I wanted a character who had moral qualms about her magic and using her magic. The church in my world preaches that magic is holy. It is not meant to be used by just any old person, and especially not by women. They corrupt it. And they make it dark and they twist it. And she has grown up with this in her ear at church every Sunday. And so when she becomes a Nightbird, she has tons of moral qualms that, you know, what does it mean to give my magic away to someone else? Will it corrupt me? Will it corrupt them? Is this morally, is this okay? Is this the right thing to do? The other two girls don't worry about that too much, but I think the three of them together create a really interesting dynamic because they are such different characters. And so, yes, I started with Mathilde and built out from her and thought about what kinds of characters would really challenge Mathilde. and would also challenge the reader to think about this world and this system in a completely different way. And I love writing a multi-POV book. This is, I think, the first time I've written three points of view, and I just fell in love with it. And the book is written in third person, which I think helped to create a unified voice for the book. But they all do have their different perspectives and voices and ways of seeing the world. And I really loved being able to transition between them.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. Like, because I always like to play around with different perspectives, but give characters that uniqueness as well. So how did you approach that? Like, how did you sort of try and make each one unique whilst maintaining that sort of overall narration?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it helped that it's in third person present. So the narration feels cohesive because it's all in third person rather than first. But I thought a lot about their origin stories, where they came from. So Asa comes from the Ilish Isles. So she grew up speaking a different language than Sarah and Matilde. And I knew, and she grew up in basically a very Ireland-esque coastal island community. And I wanted that reflected in everything she did. So, you know, she's had to learn a new language to come to the city. And so we see how she's just not quite as comfortable as the other two girls, not as comfortable in her own skin, but certainly not in her environment. I made up a little bit of the Ilish language, which was so fun. I'm sure it would not stand up if a linguist, you know, got in there and actually looked at it. But I tried to incorporate just little pieces of home into her storyline and into her voice and how she would look at things. So there's lots of Ilish lore and there are bits of Ilish language. Whereas Sayer, who grew up in a gritty part of the city, she has a lot of friends who are gang affiliated, basically. So in my world, there are lots of sandpiper gangs. So think like 1920s style criminal gangs. And that's reflected as well in her vernacular and language and the way she sees the world. She always carries a knife. She's very distrustful because she's learned to be distrustful. And so when she walks into a ballroom, she sees a bunch of people whose pockets she could pick and people who might, are they a threat to her or are they not? Whereas Matilde, that doesn't even cross her mind because she's grown up so sheltered and so safe that she thinks she owns the world. She sees the world as a game that she's winning, you know?
So
thinking about their backgrounds and where they came from and how that would change their worldview and kind of reflect their point of view, that really helped me to make sure that they felt distinct.
Nice. Great advice. The world sounds really interesting, 1920s Prohibition era. How did you sort of approach the creation of that? And one question I always think is really important is, how did you reveal that in a way that wasn't info dumpy? It was always a big problem for writers.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a reason why Nightbirds is rather a thick book. <It's because laughs> there's a lot of world building to do. I think I was about probably 20% of the way through drafting Nightbirds before it hit me. Oh, this is a prohibition story. That's what this is. This is a world where magic is illegal and it's created this underworld. I didn't start out with that idea. I think it was always swirling in the back of my mind, but I didn't really intentionally sit down and do any research on the 1920s before I started writing. But once I realized that's what I was doing, I ended up watching a documentary by Ken Burns called Prohibition. And I took all of these notes about, okay, what did this law actually do? Who did it impact? What were its ripple effects? You know, its pros and cons. How did people think about it? And then after I was done, I took my notes and I crossed out everywhere I'd put alcohol and I wrote magic instead.
Nice.
And I thought, okay, what here works and what here excites me and what doesn't. Yeah. And that was really, really helpful in framing my prohibition and figuring out for my purposes, you know, what translates from what actually happened in the 1920s into my world and makes sense for the story I'm trying to tell. So yeah, I've always been really interested in what happens when you make something illegal and you drive it underground. And again, some of this goes back to my historical research around sex work and prostitution. They're just such wild stories about what has happened when prostitution has been made illegal. In the United States, for example, during the Civil War, you know, wherever you have war, you have sex work. It's just the way it is. Soldiers need something to do in their downtime, I suppose. And it got so bad in some places in the South that they ended up, because it was illegal, all these people were getting diseases. It was a bad situation. And so the army ended up in certain places making it legal and kind of bringing it back into the light and saying, okay, well, if you want to, for a woman, if you want to engage in sex work, you need a special license and you have to go to a doctor once a week and be tested. And it actually really benefited these women because they had somewhere to go. If a soldier treated them badly, they had someone to complain to, they had regular checkups. And then of course, as soon as the war was over, you know, everything was, that was all over and it was illegal again. So, but I've always just been really interested in what happens when you make something illegal. It doesn't go away often when you're talking about alcohol, like the 1920s. Yeah. Booze didn't go away just because it was illegal. It just created this really vibrant underground, which, I mean, yeah, we read about it now and it's like, ooh, that seems very glamorous. But it had a lot of dark sides as well.
Yeah.
It created this criminal underworld, lots of gang violence. And it also meant that booze wasn't regulated very well. And so you had a lot of bootleg that could kill
yeah.
people.
And a lot of like legitimate, like sort of innocent, hardworking people would be criminals overnight. Because they might have been working in a distillery or a brewery, and then next thing, oh, they can't do that anymore. And I mean, I always think the prohibition on drugs has been one of the most damaging things to society. Nixon kicked it off in the 70s, going on a lot longer than that. But
yeah,
it created, I don't know if you've ever seen The Wire, my favorite TV show, but it just captures the impact so well. Because
yes,
you're talking about ripple effects. If you declare war on something, a prohibition, it creates the us and them attitude. And then
yeah,
next thing you know, like it's the people against the state, and the state through the eyes of the people are the police who are enforcing it. And then it's almost like we look at it in America now with the student protest. It's like militarized police. It's insane, like the level of sort of, it is like war. That's what it feels like, domestic war, and against the people that they're meant to be protecting. And that's like one example of what prohibition can do. Yeah, so it's amazing, like exploring it.
Yeah, I tried to touch on all of that in the series. I mean, you have a police called the wardens, who were the ones who were supposed to be policing prohibition. But most of prohibition in my world is policed by the church, which, as you can imagine, is problematic on a couple of different fronts. And I also tried to show how this criminal system impacted people differently. So you have girls like the Nightbirds, who are sheltered and protected and live in a world of money. And then you have the everyday person who, you know, you take some bad bootleg and it can ruin you for life. You also have in my world, so there's intrinsic magic, which is what the Nightbirds have. And then you have alchemical magic. So if you have the right knowledge and tools, you can make certain kinds of magic alchemically. And one of our main characters, Alec Padano, is something of a rogue alchemist. He brews many illegal things. And if he got caught, he might be hung. He might go to the gallows. Whereas, you know, Mathilde is protected by layers of wealth and privilege. And they are very friends. But something that they argue about a lot is exactly that. You know, he tries to tell Mathilde, you need to look beyond your world and see what's happening out here. Because for us average folk, this is a dangerous game. And these rules are unfair. And they unfairly punish those who need these things most. And you need to open your eyes and see it. And so that's a lot of what the story is about, is challenging that system and how it can be corrupted and who it hurts.
Nice. All the more reason to read.
I think so.
Definitely. So we're running out of time, but one question I always like to ask is about your experiences navigating the world of publishing. A lot of authors and writers who listen to the show always have lots of questions about these kind of things, like agents and editors and publishers. So what experiences and insights have you got to share, Kate?
Gosh, well, you know, it took me about, I'd say, 10 years of trying seriously to get an agent and then get a book deal. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to take you that long, but it might. It's all about perseverance. I think no matter where you are in your publishing career, you're going to hear no a lot. Even when you've been published, you still hear no, and you have to be ready to field those no's and to not let it knock you back too much, you know, to be able to just keep going and keep writing and knowing that one no doesn't mean that it's over and that, you know, you can't have a career in writing. So, yeah, I mean, I just, as I was working other jobs, other careers, I just kept writing away, trying to hone my craft and my voice. And yeah, I think I was five manuscripts in. I was four manuscripts in when I got an agent. And I was lucky in a way because I think I had queried with my third agent. So I had just sent out lots of, you know, letters trying to find an agent for my third manuscript, and I did not get an agent. So I was like, well, all right, that sucks, but let's keep going. So I wrote the next thing. And with my fourth manuscript, I had a bunch of critique partners actually who had been kind of forged the path ahead of me and had already gotten agents and gotten published. And a couple of them were with the same agency, Adams Literary, and they're typically closed to submissions. So they only really take authors on referral. And I was lucky enough that they put me in touch and I was able to pitch my fourth book to Josh Adams, who's now my agent, and he loved it. And yeah, I'll never forget the feeling of having that phone call with an agent and thinking, all right, it's happening. This is really happening. So I think a lot of authors, aspiring authors, struggle at that point, at the trying to get an agent point. You know, you do need an agent today. I think it's hard. I shouldn't say you absolutely need an agent, but I do think you want one if you can get one. And that can be a really big hurdle. And I think all you can do is just keep going, knowing that it's almost like dating, you know, in a way. It's like authorial dating. You have to find the right fit for you and the agent who really gets you and gets your work and is excited to help you put it out into the world. So, yeah, once I got an agent, I remember thinking, okay, that's it. I have an agent. So now I'm going to get published. That's the next step. So we took my manuscript out on submission. And while we got lots of positive feedback, in the end, no publisher picked it up. And I was really surprised by this. I don't think I was properly prepared for the fact that this happens all the time with debut authors, but also more seasoned authors. I have friends who have put out, who published three books, eight books, 10 books, and they still sometimes get proposals and manuscripts knocked back and not picked up by publishers. So I think, as I said before, you have to be prepared that there are always going to be setbacks. But I was very surprised by that. I think that was the biggest surprise for me, was like, what do you mean no one wants to publish my delightful novel? But yeah, luckily I was already working on Nightbirds and I had a decent chunk of that done. And my agent just said, just finish Nightbirds and let's keep going, you know? And so that's what I did. You focus on the next project. I think, and one of my biggest pieces of advice would be not to sit on one project too long. I think my fourth manuscript, for many different reasons, I was working on it for probably 4 years. And you can get really bogged down in your own story, in your own head, if you sit on something too long and you become really precious about it and it's really hard to let go. So yeah, I was glad that I had another very different project waiting in the wings that I could pick up and run with. And luckily that one did get published. So it's a wild roller coaster of an industry, but if you want to, it's wonderful too. I mean, it's been an incredible experience publishing Nightbirds. My publisher, Penguin in the US, have been just fantastic. They've given me so much love, and my editor has been wonderful to work with, and I feel very lucky. But it's hard too. It's hard, you know. Firebirds was the first book I wrote under deadline, under contract and under deadline, and that was like a whole new challenge to try to meet those deadlines. It can be really hard. But yeah, I think it's been mostly wonderful, but it's taken a lot of hard work and perseverance, and I think you just don't get discouraged. One person's no is another person's hell yes. So.
That's great advice. And I think the key word there is perseverance. It's there's a lot of lows, and you just got to keep powering through and trust that it'll all pay off.
Absolutely.
No, okay, thank you very much for chatting with me tonight. It's been absolutely lovely.
Oh, it's been
Learning all about
fantastic.
you, your writing, I'm particularly inspired by what inspires you. It's been really lovely hearing all about it.
Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Oh, no problem. Where's the best place for anyone who wants to learn a bit more about you and your writing to go and look?
Well, you can always go to my website, which is katejarmstrong.com, and there are lots of links there to my podcasts as well. So if you want to hear me talking in depth about writing, probably the best place to go is Pub Dates, which is my podcast with Amy Kaufman. We take readers behind the scenes on publishing Nightbirds, so you can hear all about basically in real time as I was editing and working on publicity and marketing, and then the book came out. You know, that's it's a cool glimpse behind the scenes of how a book gets made. We talk about cover design and maps and just all sorts of stuff. So if you're a fantasy lover and a writer, that is the place to go. And there's also my history podcast, The Exploress, where I talk not as much about writing, but I certainly talk a lot about history and where I get my inspiration.
Nice. I think you should come back on and talk all about some brilliant female historical figures. I mean, I like to talk all about that kind of stuff. It's great inspiration.
It
Like I
really
say,
is.
it's helped inspire your story. So, yeah, if you'd like to come back on, we'll cover that as well.
Oh, I would love to, except once you get me talking about that, I can't really stop.
Oh, no. Well, thank you, Kate. Again, it's been lovely chatting with you, and thank you everyone for listening at home.